show is on the air. 212-209-2950, or go to give to the number 2WBAI.org online. All right. It's now 3 p.m. Stay tuned for the expanded edition of Live on the Fly with Randy Credico here on WBAI New York. Let's start this show.
I like
sabotaging my program because I had sent, and you've heard it before, Craig Murray from St. Pancras Church into the third man, and he got it, Reggie got it, and he played it. It says Craig Murray, third man, and it ended up playing some 30-second audio with Julian Assange. So somebody's messing up my flow today, and they did it last week too. I don't know what it is. But it's beginning to bother me. I don't know who's doing that, but we got to go on. It's Live on the Fly. And the reason why I played Craig Murray up front was because he's in town. In fact, he's packing right now. He's going to be on the show in about 7 or 8 minutes. He's going to be in town tomorrow in New York City and to begin a 2-week pilgrimage around the country in support of Julian Assange. He'll be here. He'll be in Woodstock on Tuesday. He'll be in Baltimore on Thursday. He'll be in New York City on the 9th. We'll get to that in a minute, which happens to be the same day of the beginning of the rebellion at Attica, the 9th, and there'll be another event that day. And on the 9th will be a luncheon, at this great place called Butchers and Banquet. Butcher and Banquet on 34th Street. And it's a luncheon, and you have to have a reservation to get in. We have limited seating, but I do have 10 seats set aside for WBAI listeners who get the premium that I'm going to offer today. All right? I may as well tell you what the premium is, because I'm going to tell you a lot if we don't hear the phone ring, because we are at an existential moment here, folks. It's closer than you think. It really is. So we lose Julian Assange and we lose WBAI. What do you got? You know, I'll jump off the George Washington Bridge at that point. All right? So we got to save both WikiLeaks and this station. And so, you know, the premium that I offered a few weeks ago, the Credico Super Special, well, it includes Disturbing the Universe by Emily and Sarah Kunstler. It includes Tulia Scenes from the Drug War by Emily and Sarah Kunstler. I produced it, but they did all the work. And it also includes Bill Kunstler's very last public appearance at Caroline's with me, Urban Corey, and the I should put myself last there, with Urban Corey, the Terry Waldo Quintet, and me. All right, that was August 13th of 1995, and he died on Labor Day, this week in Labor Day, 28 years ago. So you've got those three documentaries, and you got the two by John Pilger, The Coming War with China, and The War You Don't See, along with 60 Mimics 1 and 2, which was produced right here at WBAI in 1994. And you get that for a $120 donation. You get that premium. Plus, if you do it today, you will get a seat, one of those 10 seats reserved for WBAI listeners. So you won't have to pay at the door for that, which is a lot of money at the door. You get that. You get that luncheon with Craig Murray and Scott Ritter and Margaret Kunstler and me and others on the 9th at Butcher and Banquet. So 212-209-2950. If you've already made a reservation or are committed to coming, this doesn't apply to you. It applies to new people, WBAI listeners who get that premium, the Credico Super Special. You get all of that plus the kitchen sink, which, of course, is this great luncheon with Chris Hedges and the man. It's really a luncheon with Craig Murray, and Chris is going to do the introduction. It's about Assange, okay? So it's 212-209-2950, or if you become a buddy. If you become a buddy, you get one of those seats, all right? Maybe 10, 12 seats we'll have available for WBAI. You'll meet Craig, you'll meet Chris, and you'll see me. Not that you want that. So that's 212-209-2950, the Credico Super Special. Go to give2wbai.org. Roger Waters is going to join us at some point in this program. I don't know when, but we're going to play this one excerpt from Disturbing the Universe. This is the one you've heard a million times, but, you know, it Julian Assange fits into what Bill Kunstler was talking about, and this is in wake of the verdicts and the sentences at the Chicago 7 trial.
And that's the terrible myth of organized society, that everything that's done through the established system is legal, and that word has a powerful psychological impact. It makes people believe that there is an order to life and an order to a system, and that a person that goes through this order and is convicted has gotten all that is due him, and therefore society can turn its conscience off and look to other things and other times. And that's the terrible thing about these past trials, is that they have this aura of legitimacy, this aura of legality. I suspect that better men than the world has known, and more of them, have gone to their death through a legal system than through all the illegalities in the history of man. 6 million people in Europe during the Third Reich, legal. Sacco Vanzetti, quite legal. The Haymarket defendants, legal. The hundreds of rape trials throughout the South, where black men were condemned to death, all legal. Jesus, legal. Socrates, legal. And that is the kaleidoscopic nature of what we live through here and in other places. Because all tyrants learn that it is far better to do this thing through some semblance of legality than to do it without that pretense.
All right. That's the closing. It's so fitting. The closing of Disturbing the Universe by Emily and Sarah Kunstler, a brilliant award-winning documentary about their father. It's got, we're going to play more of it in the second hour. It all depends on when Roger comes in and out. But we'll be doing a lot more shaking down here as well. And we're going to play the logical song, Come Back with the Great Craig Murray. All right? Stay tuned, folks.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. A miracle, oh, it was beautiful, magical. And all the birds in the trees, they'd be singing so happily. Oh, joyfully, oh, playfully, watching me. But then they sent me away to teach me how to be sensible, logical, oh, responsible, practical. And then they showed me a world where I could be so dependable, oh, clinical, oh, intellectual, cynical. There are times when all the world is asleep.
All right. Super Tramp. The logical song, and Ambassador Craig Murray joins us now from Edinburgh, and I know you're packing, Craig, so thank you for taking a few minutes of your packing time to share some thoughts about why you're coming here to America.
Thank you, Randy. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I'm fine. Maybe you can speak up. How about you? Is this level okay? Reggie?
No, that's great.
Okay. Yeah, you're fine. All right.
So I'm in the middle of packing. I'm at that stage where you're wondering why on earth you don't have any socks. It's quite extraordinary, no matter how many times you travel and no matter how many socks you buy.
In packing,
you always suddenly discover you're short of socks.
Yes. I have five different pair that I found this morning, and they didn't have a match to them. So I'm wearing a blue sock and a yellow sock right now. Craig, you're packing to come to the United States for a couple of weeks, and I've teased them on what you are doing here. But give us an overview of what's bringing you out here and why is it so important?
Yeah, I'm coming out really to campaign about the Assange case, try and help raise public awareness further about the dreadful attack on freedom of speech and freedom of publication, an attack on the First Amendment, which the Assange persecution represents. We have, of course, to look towards a possibility that we may not succeed in stopping the extradition here in the UK or Europe. So we have to start to prepare for the possibility that the scene of the action, if you like, moves to the United States. And also, of course, that the whole thing could be stopped at any stage by the Biden administration dropping the persecution. So that's another good reason to be coming out.
Yeah. Craig, I was just in D.C., and it's really difficult to mobilize not excitement, but enthusiasm in support of Assange. And I mean, this is not the 60s. In the 60s, people were on the streets all the time, the Vietnam War, civil rights. Something's taken place where there's kind of a malaise in this country, and maybe in Europe as well, although France seems to be perking up a little bit. What do you ascribe it to?
That's partly the effect of social media. It's also, of course, the effect of consumerism. It's not only that people aren't taking part as much in political activity together. All kinds of communal activity where people meet together are reduced. People are much more consumers within their own home, getting stuff through screens, and people don't go out and socialize so much. There just aren't so many community groups of various kinds, and participation in all kinds of community activities which involve people physically getting together, and including things like the Boy Scouts or church coffee mornings, even, you know, all those kind of social activities when people meet are less and less attended in favour of people separately sitting in their own homes communicating with each other. You know, I have teenage children, and it infuriates me sometimes. They sit there on their telephones communicating with their friends, and their friends live literally 100 yards away. Why don't they walk out the door and speak to them? But no, they all prefer to sit each in their own homes or communicating with each other. And this is just part of the way society is changing. And so I don't think the difficulty in getting people out to political events is really unrelated to the difficulty in getting people out to anything.
Right. I don't know about where it is there. You don't have a subway, but I took the subway here. I drove up to Woodstock to visit the place where we're having that first event on the 5th yesterday, and visit the gravesite of William Kunstler, where we're gonna drop by up there on our way to Woodstock on Tuesday. Actually, it's in Olive, New York, and it's a beautiful place. But on the subway, after I dropped the car off, I took the subway to the station. It's the same view that I always get on the subway. No books. Nobody's reading a book. Nobody's reading a magazine. Nobody is reading a newspaper. Everybody on the bloody subway, that car that I was in, it didn't matter what car I was in because it was going to be the same, was on their cell phone, and they're not reading Dostoevsky and Tolstoy. You know, I have no idea. They're texting. Their minds are – it's become the new opium den, you know, this whole cell phone craze. It's really a pandemic. How do you feel about the overuse of cell phones?
Well, that's something where we're not going to change. I was actually quite surprised to hear from the people who do all the tech work on my own website, people who administer it and moderate it for me, that about 80% of the people who visit my website nowadays are reading it on their cell phones, and various changes to the formatting of articles and things have been made to make that a more comfortable and pleasant experience. Because, you know, when I started my blog 15 or 16 years ago, it didn't ever occur to me anyone would read it on a telephone, and it does seem, you know, to me who's older and my eyesight's not great, it does seem an uncomfortable format to be doing that. But no, that's where the future is, and we just have to live with it. And of course, what we have to make sure is that those people on the subway staring at their phones are looking at my website and looking at other radical and exciting content, and not just looking at people dancing on TikTok.
Yeah. Craig, getting back to Julian now, where your estimation? Where is he? I mean, you know him better than anybody. You've been out there passionately for him. That speech you gave at St. Pancras Church in December of 2019 just emblematic of the kind of powerful eloquence that you have spewed out there in support of Assange. You've been in that embassy more times than anybody probably with him. I don't know, and you probably have visited him in Belmarsh, but we won't get into that. What have you heard, or what have you seen his disposition right now, and how is he psychologically? I mean, we heard from John and Gabriel, but Gabriel hadn't seen him in 6 months, so. Can you give us any kind of update on how he might be feeling mentally and physically?
Yeah, well, I have been visiting Julian in Belmarsh, but I've been put under an obligation not to speak about it because that was the basis on which I was allowed in. Julian is a strong person. Let me say that. You know, there are many people who would have completely physically and mentally collapsed under the terrible way he's been treated, the solitary confinement, the inadequate medical care, the enormous stress and pressure. But Julian is a strong-willed, strong-minded person, and a person of remarkable intellect and remarkable moral authority, able to summon remarkable moral force. And I'm confident that once we get Julian out, we will have the old Julian back again. But, you know, he hasn't been lost or destroyed by the experience.
Right. Well, where is it legally right now for people that don't know? Because it's hard to get information. I know there's some back channel stuff out there in the air about some kind of deal. Concretely, can you tell us where it really stands, or are we all kind of in the dark here?
Yeah, I think you know, there've been noises made by the United States ambassador to Australia saying that, you know, a plea deal is possible, and that's what the Australian government have been pushing for as a way to solve it. But I'm not, what I can tell you is that there have been no official approaches from the American government indicating any willingness to soften or ameliorate their position. You know, the position of the Biden administration still seems to be that they wish to persecute and destroy Julian and lock him up for life for publishing the truth about war crimes. And for publishing, we should never forget, Julian is the publisher. Julian is not the whistleblower. The whistleblower was Chelsea Manning. Julian is just a publisher, just as the Guardian and the New York Times and the Washington Post were publishers of the same information. There just is no evidence of any sincerity on behalf of the United States government in these noises off we've been hearing. It seems to be that to placate public opinion in Australia, where, you know, public opinion is over 80% in favour of dropping the charges and allowing Julian to go home to his native country, that in order to placate public opinion in Australia, the American ambassador has made comments about, oh, well, a plea deal might be possible. But this is just rubbish. You know, this is just talk in the ear. There's been no kind of approach or indication from the Justice Department of anything like that at all. It's just not true. It's a false statement they've been putting out to try to placate public opinion in Australia.
I mean, Craig, it really is not a propitious time for the Biden administration. He's so far down in the polls. For him to, at this point, support the extradition of Assange, does he really want this on his plate?
It's extraordinary to me. I mean, you know, I'm not an American anyway, so in a sense, it's no skin off my nose, and I'm certainly not a supporter of Donald Trump. But to somebody who's not an American, in fact, to the entire rest of the world, it looks quite extraordinary that the United States is trying to lock up its chief political opponent, the chief political opponent of the current administration, the guy who is likely to be the opposition candidate and the guy who is quite likely to win the presidential election. The way they're trying to stop him winning the presidential election isn't by beating him in an election, it's by locking him up. And that's what, it's not what democracies do, that's what other countries do, it's what dictatorships
Imran
do.
Imran Khan, it's the same situation as Imran Khan.
Well, precisely, the United States are behind what's happening to Imran Khan, and it's exactly what the United States is doing, it's exactly what it accuses Russia of doing with Navalny. You know, this looks very, very strange. And if at the same time you're trying to lock up your main political opponent so you don't have to fight him in a democratic election, and you're trying to lock up the most famous publisher in the world simultaneously for publishing stuff which is true, that's a terrible look. I mean, that's absolutely astonishing. I don't know whether Joe Biden's trying to go down as running the most despotic government in Western history, but that's certainly what we're looking at.
Right. Well, I think he's the worst president. I'd give Millard Fillmore much better. All right. Listen, I think we're going to play this clip. You're going to be on the 9th at Butcher and Banker on 34th Street at noon with Chris Hedges. You'll be doing the show the day before. This is something I want you to comment on. And I totally subscribe to this, and I have for a while, if you concur with Chris Hedges' analysis of this. This is a 33-second pastiche from a speech he gave down in D.C. October 8th of last year. Reggie, the Hedges piece. We're going to play the Hedges piece here. All right, one second, Craig. Here we go. I think we got it now. All right, here we go.
Driving. The lynching of Julian is not here on Pennsylvania Avenue. It is in Langley, Virginia, located at a complex we will never be allowed to surround, the Central Intelligence Agency. It is driven by a secretive interstate, one where we do not count, in the mad pursuit of empire and ruthless exploitation. Because the machine of this modern Leviathan was exposed by Julian and WikiLeaks, the machine demands revenge.
All right, so Craig, it is the CIA. I mean, I'm convinced it's the CIA driving this, Biden is afraid of them, and Garland really is just a paper tiger who's just a figurehead, and he's not driving this prosecution. Your thoughts?
Yeah, well, it's the CIA and the FBI. It's the security services together who very much run the state. I mean, one thing which we've seen for sure, I think, is that the United States is not a functioning democracy. It's a country run by its security services. And of course, the greatest illustration of that was the case of the Hunter Biden laptop. And the biggest single interference in a democratic election in history in the United States was the interference by the security services to put out the lie that Hunter Biden's laptop was a fake at a crucial time in the last presidential election. There's no doubt that swung the result of an election of which quite a small number of votes, a few thousand votes in a few key states, would have given a different result. And the result obtained was obtained by numerous security service operatives, just retired ones who went public, but with the assistance and support of the entire still functioning and not retired security service establishment. All coming out and claiming that a laptop, which they knew fine well was genuine, was actually a Russian fake. And that, of course, goes back to the whole entirely fake and lying Russiagate narrative and the attempt to overturn the result of the 2016 election by claiming the fake Russiagate scandal smear, which had no truth behind it whatsoever. So it's been plain, it's been absolutely plain that the security services and the deep state interest, which operates largely through, not entirely through, but the Bush camp are aligned to the security state interest, and the Clinton camp are aligned to the security state interest, and the Obama camp are aligned to the security state interest. But they decide who gets elected, they decide who runs a country, and then they decide what happens in the country. And I think you would have to be seriously not paying attention not to realize that that is how the United States has functioned for the last decade.
I think we're just on complete war footing from this point on, and the war machine and the national security state repressing dissent is very, very obvious. I mean, Tony Blinken is the one that had these guys come out, these so-called 51, I don't know, former intelligence officials write this letter saying that the whole thing was a fake and it was Russia propaganda. And so that was Tony Blinken. And so he and his fellow neoconservatives end up, you know, jumping in at the very front of the foreign policy arena there for Biden. And it's just been war and belligerence everywhere. So I guess that's the direction we're going, and they'll do anything to keep it going. So it's we are in very uncertain times. We're going to be Roger's joining us in a few minutes. You have a few minutes to stick around, Craig? You've got to go back to packing.
I have to go back to packing shortly, but if I can do, I'd just like to say how much I agree with your last comment and how important it is to remember that war is the object. That is the entire object of them keeping who they want to keep in power, because they want these forever wars that fuel the vast amounts of money that go into the defense budget, billions and billions, hundreds of billions of dollars. And the defense budget is the most opaque, most corrupt, and most easy to skim budget of all, which is why that's where they want the money. And the whole object of this is to keep war going, to keep the Ukraine war going. Previously, it was to keep Syria going, to keep Iraq going, to keep Libya going, to keep Afghanistan going. Years and years and years, in which the poor schmuck of the American taxpayer has had all the money that could have gone towards making his country a better place instead be creamed off to the defense industry. And that's the entire point of this entire exercise.
And the UK basically is a microcosm of how it works here, because you have the Labour Party and the Tory Party both supporting wars everywhere. And you got no press there anymore. You've got the GCHQ, and you have MI6, MI5, and they're all working together with the military department of the Ministry of Defense. War is their industry, and people are making a lot of money. So, you know, it's obvious. We're going to take a quick break. Don't go anywhere. I think Roger will be joining us in a second. I'm going to play this. I don't know if you were at this event, Craig, on the street, but this is there was a demonstration.
Hello.
All right, we'll be right with Roger Waters right after this music and a station ID. All right.
How I wish you were here. You're just two last souls swimming in a fishbowl year after year.
All right, that is not the version I was going to play. The one I was going to play was the one that was done at a demonstration or a rally in London a couple of years back with John Pilger and Roger Waters. So I'm Randy Credico. This is Randy Credico Live on the Fly on 99.5 FM in New York City, WBAI, WBAI.org. And we have Craig Murray on the line still. And now joining us is Roger Waters. Welcome to the program, Roger.
Hey. Well, there I am.
You've
turned me up. Thank goodness. Do you remember all the trouble we had last time?
Yes.
I couldn't hear myself.
Yeah.
No, but I can. Hey, Craig.
Hello, Roger.
Hello, mate. How are you?
I'm on good form. Yeah,
I'm very glad to hear that.
You guys take it from here. Let me, I have to step out for a second. Go ahead, Roger.
That's it. He F's off, doesn't
no,
he?
No, no, I'm just joking.
Billions of bloody text messages going, where the hell are you?
Yeah.
Why haven't you logged in? And blah, blah, blah. No. When I'm trying to have a bit of a shave to, you know, to get ready to come on the radio and talk to all my friends out there in radio land.
All right. So, Roger, we were just talking about Julian Assange here, about the – and you've echoed it many times. You know, Craig, let me just say – one person that's reaching a massive amount of people is Roger through his show, This Is Not a Drill. And I think The Dark Side of the Moon is coming out in London in October. And is that right? another brick in the wall in October, and then back to South America with This Is Not a Drill. And I got to tell you, you have that 10-minute stretch of nothing but Julian Assange, and people are really captivated by it, Roger.
They're captivated by what?
By your performance that and This Is Not a Drill.
I'm doing This Is Not a Drill again in South America starting in November. In London in a few weeks' time, in beginning of October 8th and 9th, I'm doing a live performance of the new recording of Dark Side of the Moon, Dark Side of the Moon Redux.
Right.
So that's what's going on. It's got nothing to do with the brick in the wall, as far as I know.
I know it doesn't. I know it's the Dark Side of the Moon, October 8th and October 9th. And you just released that. That's coming out October 1st. And you can get Time Today, new version of Time Today. And Ian Anderson said it was great. So I don't know what you thought about that.
That's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Hang on, I know who Ian Anderson is. He's the father of one of my road crew, isn't he? No, he's not. Inspector B is. Ian Anderson is the other OPCW inspector from Duma.
Am I the wrong? Am I the wrong guy? Is it Ian? Who's the guy from Jethro Tull?
That's what I thought.
Well, the bloke with one leg.
Yeah, the bloke with one leg. All right, he said some nice things this morning about
him.
It. Yes.
You mean the other Ian Anderson?
Yeah, right. Okay, yes. Cool. All right. So about this, the Dark Side of the Moon Redux. All right, let's get back. Craig was talking about the persecution of Assange. He's coming in for a couple of weeks. We hope we get to break bread with you one of those days. And he and I both agree, and we just played a clip of Chris Hedges, that this is the CIA, this is the war machine that is behind all of this. It's not really Merrick Garland. He's just a cog in the wheel, and it's the national security state, i.e. definitely the CIA that's doing this. And I know you've talked about this before, but can you just give us your thoughts?
Do you know, I go all cold now when I have to. I mean, I focus on it. I don't focus on it all the time, but it's with me all the time. Almost every waking minute of my life, I think about Julian and Stella, who I got to know a little bit because she came to a couple of the gigs in London when we were there. And it's so chilling that this is still going on and that it's there. Everybody knows everything that there is to know about it. Everybody knows that Jonathan Swift, or whatever the High Court judge's name was in London, is completely bent. He's just riding to orders. I think maybe it was Craig who said earlier in one interview that I heard how, you know, they pick up what they're supposed to do in the High Court, in the club. For my... You know, I have many, many sins in my life, and one of them is that I used to own racehorses. That is not a sin, by the way, all right? Before people start quoting me and saying, Roger Waters says it's a sin to own a racehorse, it's not, all right? It's a figure of speech, all right? But at one point, I joined a London club. What's it? The Turf Club. It wouldn't surprise me if I'm still a member of the Turf Club, which is in Pall Mall, which is a gentleman's club. And as you can imagine, there are precious few gentlemen in it. But the only reason I did that, and I can admit this now, is because they have a bloody great marquee at the Cheltenham races. And if you're interested in national hunt racing, which is racing where instead of the horses just running round on a flat piece of grass, they have to jump over fences or hurdles on the way round, steeplechasing or hurdling, it's called, to be a member of the Turf Club so that you can gain access to that tent for you and your mates is huge. It's a great thing. And what a wonderful race meeting it is, Ron. And having a bit of a gamble, you know, and enjoying some semblance of life with our friends, without our friends being locked up and being, in Julian's case, liable to be taken to America and locked up until he dies, which won't be very long. But for in just in case he survives for a bit, lock him up for 175 years. And then it really is a death sentence. And we're doing that to him. Jonathan Swift, his worship, in his bloody wig. We're doing that to Julian Assange because he was a brave journalist who was so brave, probably foolhardily brave, and told the truth about the war crimes of the American Empire, for which non-crime they're going to crucify him. And it knocks the edge off a beautiful day when the sun is shining and the monarchs are flying, you know, and the geese are beginning to land on the pond and blah and blah and blah. My daughter told me day before yesterday that there were black swans on the River Test in Hampshire. Isn't that amazing? Anyway, I'm rambling on.
No, but it's great.
Weird that we live in this insane world where these MFs murder people absolutely with complete impunity. And part of the reason is that, as we all know, we live in a world, well, I live in the United States, but it's the same in the UK where Craig lives. We live in a world where the mainstream media is completely tame, all of them, to a man. They do exactly what they're told and they spread the narrative that is fed to them by the ruling class. And as the UK is a vassal state of the American Empire, so the UK, the press in the UK does exactly the same thing that the press does in the United States of America. It's homogenized. They tell the same disgusting lies to us all the time. I had a mate round here 2 days ago. I'm not going to name his name. He's an intelligent man in his 40s, I suppose. But he does make the mistake of reading, I don't know, the Washington Post or the New York Times or something like that. And we drifted, rather unwisely, I thought, onto the subject of Ukraine, which is something else that we're not allowed to talk about. Because if you talk any sense about the Ukraine, you're a traitor to some cause or other. Anyway, we talked about it, and he was doing the normal thing, but he toned it down a bit because I was in the room of Putin's the new Hitler and Putin must be killed and we've got to kill all the Russians and then we can start on the Chinese, all that nonsense. He wasn't going there because he's too intelligent and too clever to be sucked into the idea that a war with Russia and a war with China would be a bloody good idea. What? Obviously, it's complete insanity. Anyway, but he did say this. He suddenly said, oh, well, you know, but Putin. I mean, he told all those lies about there being Nazis in Ukraine. And I sat there with my jaw hanging to the floor. And I went, I won't mention his name. I won't mention your name, mate. Okay, I won't mention his name. And I looked at him and then I kind of sniggered. Because this man who reads the New York Times doesn't know the history of Stefan Banderas, who they have statues of him in towns in upstate New York, for F's sake, near Albany.
Yes.
This man is one of the most insane, or was one of the most heinous, violent Nazi criminals all through the 20s and 30s and through the Second World War, murdering Poles and Jews and any Russian speakers he could find. And he's now a national hero in Kyiv.
Wow.
People march up and down the streets carrying torches, shouting his name. We are the pure people of Ukraine, and anyone who isn't us has to be killed. And this poor bloke who reads the New York Times thinks there are no neo-Nazis in Ukraine. It's beyond all imagination. So when I say I go through my life with this weird, with this strange feeling of how can this happen? Well, all you have to do is you wake up in the morning and you go, have they let Julian out of prison yet? No. What a surprise. I mean, obviously they haven't. Hopefully they will. Hopefully, you know, John Shipton's recent journeys around the United States of America, and Craig being here now and going, you know, to the People's Forum and here and there. We go to the same meetings over and over and over again. Even I have stood in the street in Washington, D.C. from time to time
and
with
New
my
York.
Old friend Randy Credico.
Yes.
And does anybody take any notice? Yeah, of course they take notice. Randy Credico and his effing dog, both of them. They're always there. You know, and along with our friends, and there's about 100 of us.
Well,
and you go, this is mind-bogglingly ununderstandable until we go back to the beginning of my rant to you talking about, well, yeah, the CIA is a big part of whatever they are, whoever this ruling class are, who keep us in a state of perpetual war and murder anybody or try and silence anybody who speaks any truth ever about anything. That's in Ed Sheeran just sold another 5 million concert tickets. They don't mind, but that's fine, you know, because it's completely irrelevant. But this stuff that affects their general charge towards the edge of the cliff to drag the rest of us willingly following them to our deaths on the rocks below. That's what they care about. They care about anybody pointing that out to the rest of the population. But they're on fairly safe ground because, as far as one can tell, the rest of the population are not interested.
Right. Right, they're not interested. Craig, you want to pick up on that? There's a lot to go through there.
It's slightly depressing. But, yeah, that's certainly true. It is very difficult to mobilize people and make them realize that they have an interest in freedom of speech. They have an interest in good governance. They have an interest in stopping human rights abuse. And, of course, it's difficult because, you know, some of the standard arguments you use, you say, well, you know, at the moment they're coming for Julian Assange and his freedom, but next thing they'll come for you and your freedom. And people look at you as though you're mad because they actually don't want to do anything anyway. They don't have an opinion. They don't want to dissent. They just want to sit watching television and eating chips. So they think, why would anyone come for me? And there's a certain amount of truth of that. Until we can reactivate the idea of civic engagement in society and of democracy as a you know, an active, functioning concept rather than something in which you just go out and vote every four.
It's not here, is it, Craig? There is no functioning democracy in the United States of America. I hopefully all those of us who are gathered around these microphones agree on that. Anyway, if we could get the rest of the population to agree on it, then they would either vote for Bobby Kennedy or Cornel West. There are no other candidates, certainly no Republican or Democratic sanctioned candidate for the presidency of the United States is worth a farthing because they're all puppets and they're all controlled by whoever the ruling class are. And it's mainly, I think, this is only my opinion, obviously, and why might I be correct about this? I don't know, partly because a lot of the evidence supports this view, which is that it's actually the love of money and the desire to win and to increase one's personal wealth. That is the dragon in the back of the cave that makes it impossible for us to behave like a society of human beings who care about our brothers and sisters and who care about this small, fragile, beautiful planet that we all live on, which we are, at the behest of the ruling class, destroying hand over fist every minute of every hour of every day.
Right. Craig, can you respond to that? Because I want to play something here in a second.
I think I'd respond, if you like, by reasons to be cheerful, which is...
Good.
That's definitely true. But love of money and love of materialism, and as we were discussing before Roger joined us, that particularly the fact that the easiest way for politicians and the ultra wealthy to gather huge amounts of money is through the defence budget, because in terms of state budgets, that's the easiest one to skim. But the pursuit of things, the pursuit of material wealth, is going to collide, is colliding already, and is going to collide much more noticeably with the ability of the Earth to continue producing this stuff. We are heading into serious resource crises and serious climate crises as a conflict of all this unrestrained wealth-producing economic activity. And the other thing, of course, is the lack of the increasingly lopsided and distribution of that wealth, the extraordinary degrees of wealth inequality we are now approaching, which are getting back to sort of 18th century levels of wealth inequality, where more and more people are going to notice that their planet is being destroyed and they're not actually getting any of the wealth that's being generated. So I don't think this is something which is forever sustainable. But we're in a very, very bad position of society at the moment. But I think it's going to collapse on its own logical inconsistencies.
I want to play something here because you mentioned Cornel West. And it was a couple of years ago, I think October 14th, 2021, where at the Theater 80 St. Mark's, Roger, you unveiled The Bar and that wonderful tune, wonderful number. And this is what he said after you finished. And you mentioned Cornel West as a candidate. And I want to play this here and come back to you.
The great... And then the situated in the bars was so deep. Because I'm sure Brother Roger knows that the greatest play ever written, which is The Indictment of American Empire, was written by an Irish genius named Eugene O'Neill. Right around the corner, Harry Hope Saloon, the Ice Man Cometh. The Ice Man Cometh. Hickey, a salesman, not the genius of Arthur Miller, the death of a salesman that sells products. But Hickey was a seller of dreams. And those dreams were lies. And those lies revealed crimes. That's what WikiLeaks is about. That's what Brother Julian is about. The lies that reveal crimes. And no regime, no status quo, no empire, no predatory capitalist regime wants to hear the lies about itself exposed in every corner of the globe. That's why he's in prison. That's why he's a political prisoner, Sister Margaret. Because he's a truth teller. He's a truth teller.
All right, there you go. That you remember that moment, Roger? Roger, Cornel West is an interesting possibility, or not a possibility, probably can't win, but the fact that he will bring the Assange case to the fore and kind of make the Biden campaign a little nervous. What do you think?
Well, yeah, will he? I mean, I don't think he'll make the Biden campaign nervous. But he will definitely speak the truth because he is a truth teller. And obviously, Cornel West is a brilliant, brilliant mind. And more importantly than that, he is a big, big heart. And those are things that brilliant minds and big hearts are sorely lacking in the corridors of power. None of the people in this current administration have big minds, and none of them have big hearts. And those are the things that we lack. You know, it may be that Bobby Kennedy as well will tell some truth in as he passes and continues to try and maintain a place on the road towards him, having a bit of a tilt at the presidency. So who knows, but the chances of the machine being knocked off the rails, consolidated as it is in its tyranny and its tyrannous grip of this country, I think is fairly slim. I hope I'm wrong. I'd like to be more optimistic about the upcoming, about the 2024 presidential election. I mean, look what happened. The last time there was a, after Ralph Nader and after, who was Jill Stein, was it? Who was the Green Party candidate and whatever. And there were a few other crazed libertarian independents who I didn't have a huge amount of time for. But after those, in, the last credible candidate as a president was Bernie Sanders. And Hillary Clinton stuck him in a railroad car and drove him out into the desert and had him shot. They all connived together. The Democrats connived together. And then they blamed it on the Russians. All, they didn't actually blame the fact that they'd done it on the Russians, but they made a huge smokescreen by saying that the Russians had hacked into their computer and given the information to Julian Assange. And it's since been absolutely, well, I nearly said proved, certainly to my satisfaction, that nobody hacked into the DNC computer. Somebody stuck a thumb drive in the side of it and took some of those emails, those Clinton emails out, and got them to Julian. And some of us know a lot more about that than I do, well, Craig so knows. I'll shut up.
But, Craig knows.
I know this. But when you think about it, all right, Bernie couldn't have told you where Venezuela was, if you'd asked him. You know, he's very, very, what's the word, parochial.
Right.
Exactly. U.S.-centric. He had no idea what's going on in the West of the world, but he did at least have a faintly left-wing view of the way the American working class, the blue-collar worker and the white-collar worker in the United States of America should be treated. And it wasn't the way they'd been treated since he was railroaded out of the Democratic primaries by Hillary Clinton and the rest of them in the Democrat. And they would do it again. If somebody else tried to come up through the ranks of the Democrats, they would be railroaded in exactly this way. And funnily enough, Bernie's now joined them. The people who destroyed him, he's now
co-opted,
I believe. Yeah. Bandstanding for Biden in his re-elect. And the idea of Joe Biden standing for, as a president, you know, he can hardly climb up the steps into Air Force One, and he can't speak sentence without dribbling.
It's
just beyond all belief. And yet, it's taken seriously by the mainstream media, all the television stations, whatever they are, whatever. The Overton window is so small now. Right. That it's a complete charade.
Well, speaking of Bernie Sanders, it's okay, but speaking of Bernie Sanders, you know, when there was an event down in D.C. back in January and Jeremy Corbyn was here, he told me, I had lunch, dinner with him. He says, I met with Sanders today, and two things we couldn't talk about. One was Ukraine war. The other was Julian Assange. Didn't want to have anything to do with that. Craig, why would Bernie Sanders not want to talk about Ukraine and Julian Assange with Jeremy Corbyn?
Well, I guess he's bought into the security service agenda. Is a basic answer to that. It's interesting and quite scary the number of people who consider themselves to be of the left who look for some improvement in domestic policy, a few changes in maybe tax or welfare or health care that would benefit working class people to some extent.
Prescription drugs.
But that's as far as it goes. When it looks to foreign policy, they are still fully behind the imperialist agenda and are terrified of the charge of being traitors or unpatriotic if they break away from that American imperialist agenda. That affects so many people on the left, even people whose, and I don't just mean the fake left, the kind of Keir Starmer pretend to be left or Joe Biden pretend to be left. I mean people who genuinely are left in the sense that they do want more redistributive domestic policies. They're still terrified to be seen out as of line, particularly on the Ukraine war, whereas it's taken as a absolute touchstone of morality that you know, you want... You want millions of people to die. You want massive blood. You want vast artillery battles raging over Crimea. And if you don't want that, then you're a bad person.
AOC. AOC comes to mind.
Got into that circumstance.
AOC comes into mind. She's one, and I'm going to actually be leaving the station and running against her, a token anti-war platform. I am, all right? I've been drafted. So, but somebody's got to take a stand against the – she's the pro-war candidate. I'm the anti-war candidate. Roger, I mean, are you disappointed by AOC's turn towards the establishment Democratic mindset?
Yeah, of course I am. I mean, I don't know the woman. I shouldn't really rail against her, but I do remember at the beginning, and she seems to have developed pretensions of how she might ingratiate herself with the power of the higher, whoever party in the world, because she may see herself potentially as a future presidential candidate. Who knows? It's a very power, as we know, is a corrupting influence, just like wealth. And so it may be that she certainly speaks as if she's become corrupted by it.
Right.
And she is playing the old record of, well, I have to throw all my principles out of the cart, otherwise I won't be allowed to stay on the cart. And if I do stay on the cart, I might eventually get to drive it, and then I could help people. I would be in a better position to help people. So I'll forget all my principles and do that, and it'll all come right in the end. It will have been. No, AOC, no. The end does not justify the means. You have to stand by your principles if you have any.
Right.
So, no.
All right, well,
but
yes.
I tend not to talk about much about – this is rare for me to dip my – toe into the muddy pond of American domestic politics. But I do know that I can remember to the day when I lost all respect for Bernie Sanders, and it was, I think, 19th of February, sometime like that. I mean, no, in 2019, when Washington, D.C. tried to install Guaido as the president of Venezuela, you know, from Washington, nothing to do with Venezuela or the people of Venezuela, or nothing to do with it. And Bernie Sanders stood up and rah-rahing with the rest of them.
Yeah.
Yep, he's the man, he's the president of Venezuela. What? Have you ever been to Venezuela? Have you ever heard of Simon Bolivar? Do you know what Hugo Chavez did for that country? Do you know anything about it at all, except that it's got a lot of oil and other very, very valuable minerals under the surface of the ground, which you lot want to get your hands on. And, of course, he doesn't. That's all he knows about it.
Yeah.
But that's the only important thing. And it was Obama who started the sanctions, let us not forget. Mm-hmm. And they're still going on. Whoops.
Mark Fenwick.
There goes my phone.
It's all right. Go ahead. This is live on the fly. We accept every...
Yeah, well,
it's okay.
Just a phone call. I've turned the ringer off now.
All right.
But.
Does anyone know who the United States claim is currently president of Venezuela? Because I see that on this Twitter feed has stopped pretending to be president.
Nobody. They are.
They think there isn't one.
they're keeping our friend Alex Saab in jail in Miami, on the grounds that there is no government in Venezuela, so he cannot be a diplomat.
Wow.
That's literally, they tried to make that argument in court when they said, no, you can't be let out. He's got all the papers. He obviously is a diplomat. You know, when he was arrested in Cape Verde Islands or wherever it was, he was on his way, I think, to do a deal with the Iranians so that they could sort out their economy a bit. And when he was stolen off the high seas by the pirates from the United States of America and locked up. And there's no case against him at all for anything.
I know, but they'll find
him. He's just like Julian Assange.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, what we're going to play right now, gentlemen, is we were talking about, when are we going to rise up? When are we going to get into that 1789 Paris mode? And I know, Craig, you asked for this. I sent the opera by Roger Caira, and I want to play. This is Paris in Disarray, and I think we're getting to this moment. I know maybe in Paris right now they are. Let me just play this segment from or this number from Caira by Roger Waters. It's brilliant.
88, the line was aching cold, it chilled the very soul. They came from the country in twos and threes, a trickle, a river, a torrent, a sea. Driven by hunger, driven by pain, 100,000 leaves the ground. Hundred dead, shot down like rats. 300 lives snuffed out like that. Have a care if you treat your people like vermin. You could end up with blood-stained vermin. But soft as ever in the ebb and flow, sweet reason deft and incorrupt, adoring of the humankind, illuminates man's plight. Should he entertain the choice between the dark.
All right, that's some Caira, masterpiece, a three-act opera by Roger Waters. Craig, what's it going to take for the people to rise up like they did in Paris in the spring of 1789?
The French are wonderful. They keep rising up quite often. I was in Marseille about a month ago, just after the latest riots there. And when the French get annoyed about something, they properly let the government know, big time. And it's great in a way that there's still that that sense of popular sovereignty in France. And there's still also, Sarkozy, who I've got, you know, who's not a French politician I particularly have ever liked, but he came out two or three days ago and made, you know, obvious and very sensible comments on the situation in Ukraine and said this, you know, fanatical anti-Russian position wanting to fight this war to some glorious conclusion makes no sense and there has to be a diplomatic solution. And unlike the rest of Europe, he wasn't cried down in France. There's a much more pragmatic, sensible, and in a way principled level of political debate in France than it is in either the UK or the United States, and that's good to see. Incidentally, I haven't. You sent me the link the other day. I haven't watched Saida yet, though. I was delighted to see it was in Poznan, which is one of my very, well, that performance was in Poznan, which is one of my favorite places in the world, and when I've got some really interesting stories about Poznan and Harry's Bar, which I'll tell you when we meet up, Roger. They're definitely not things you could tell over the radio.
All right. Well, I look forward to hearing them. It was interesting that the main thing that Sarkozy suggested was the idea of referenda in Donetsk and Luhansk and whatever the other, Kherson and the other oblasts in the Ukraine. So, and of course, everybody throws their hands up, which is exactly what happened in the Crimea in 2015, when it became part of the Russian Federation, was that the people went, no, we don't want this government, this new government. It's not been elected by us. It's not, because there's a lot of neo-Nazi feeling involved in Kyiv. We're worried about, so they had a referendum, and I think it was over 90% of them said, no, please, can we join the Russian Federation? So that will all this nonsense that Zelensky keeps talking about, reinvading Crimea, and it becoming part of you, that is never, ever, ever going to happen. So Sarkozy is completely correct. They must stop killing each other. Stop killing all those Ukrainian young men. Please. Right. And then once you've done that, then you can figure it's going to take years and years and years, and it's going to have to be sorted out. But what Sarkozy is suggesting is exactly what lots of intelligent people expressing the voice of reason have been saying about the possible future for Ukraine for the last, well, certainly ever since the war began.
Craig, you were actually, I think, somewhat involved in the March, late March, April, until it was tanked by Boris Johnson. Some kind of a settlement there, some kind of peace accord. Do you see any progress in this going the other way, coming to an end, or is it too late now? Is the enmity between the two nations too profound?
Well, yeah.
And talk about the Nazis, because...
Well, will the Germans get angry at some point? Yes, they bloody well will. And I was interested in what... I'm sorry to interrupt, but what Craig was saying about the French, the Gilets Jaunes, which are the forces of resistance, the working people, the yellow jackets... what they call them, they are the inheritors of the spirit of the sans-culottes from the 18th century. That's who they are. And Craig is absolutely right. They're not nearly as tame, certainly, as the population of the UK. And I don't know why that is, because they're a colonial country as well. So they've always felt superior to everybody. And they had that wonderful foreign legion that could go around the world beating people up. Not quite to the extent that the UK did, but sorry, I didn't mean
to bring
the Gilets Jaunes into it, but... What was your question?
No, it was a question to Craig. I said,
"Yeah,
Craig, what is it going to take for people to actually hit the streets?" You said in Paris, it's better now. Where is this war going at this point? The Poles, not the Poles, but the Hungarian leader Orbán came out the other day and said, "This has got to come to an end because it's just." It's a 7-1 differential in the amount of casualties, and
I have no time whatsoever for these daft casualty figures put out.
Are they bad? Are they phony?
Yes.
Okay, I don't know.
The Russians say they've killed half a million Ukrainians. The Ukrainians say they've killed half a million.
So Russians. I don't know, Craig. I'm just saying what I hear in the newspapers.
Is really silly.
Okay,
but this war is at a. Ukrainian society with the collapse that they had 400,000, that's half the number of British dead in the First World War, which happened over a 4-year period and destroyed British society almost.
Okay.
All
right, wait a second. I'm just saying what I hear. I'm saying what I hear. That's all.
In a year. So let's not get into the silliness. Well, what we've got is a horrible stuck conflict where tens of thousands of people are dying in the barbaric and nasty way, and most of them on both sides are young people who don't really want to be there, who are being churned into this killing machine, and the front line's not moving. I mean, this famous Ukrainian counteroffensive has gained in places, the furthest it has gained in a few small areas is about 7 or 8 miles, and in most places it's gained a few hundred yards, and in other parts of France it's actually gone backwards. So that, you know, the idea that Ukraine is going to break through and take Crimea, it's for the birds. It's complete and utter nonsense. It's just a terrible killing stalemate. But of course that's what the people who promote the war want, because it's using up a huge amount of weaponry and bringing massive contracts for the defence industries, of which, of course, the contracts for the weapons actually sent to Ukraine, which by and large are clapped out old NATO equipment nobody wanted, they're not. The big money is in the increase in NATO budgets to cope with the so-called Russian threat. That's where the big money is. It's not what's being sent in to Ukraine, it's what people are spending on the national budgets for new weapons they're keeping at home, because this is all such a big feeding frenzy for the military and the security services. So, but it's ordinary people having to pay for the fact that their government expenditure is being diverted into weapons instead of into more useful things. And in Germany in particular, you know, you have massive inflation. Energy prices have gone through the roof. You've got horrible homelessness on the streets of Berlin. Rents are through the roof. Germany is probably suffering economically more than anyone. The UK is suffering economically. The United States is suffering economically. Ordinary people are suffering. And as it becomes obvious that this war is going nowhere, and isn't the kind of glorious victory that we were, you know, it was being painted as, I think the popular mood will change. I really do. I'm quite hopeful in that way. And to that extent, Orban is right. But I mean, Orban is absolutely an outlier. Orban is at the far end of European opinion on this, so he shouldn't be taken as a straw in the wind or a guide to what others are thinking in any serious way. But it's undoubtedly true that Ukraine is a much smaller country than Russia. It's an extremely corrupt country. It's got far less people. So in the long term, Ukraine can't win the war. And the idea that through conventional fighting, Ukraine's going to take back.
Neither can NATO. NATO can't win the war either, because we can all lose it in a nuclear conflagration, but nobody can win that. This is a proxy war against.
I agree entirely. The only way this war can't be won, as you say, there's no way. Well, there's no way at all that conventional forces of Ukraine would be able to push into Crimea. And if they did, then it would probably be, there'd be a huge risk of nuclear conflict in which everybody dies and nobody wins that. This is not a winnable war by Ukraine and NATO. So, and that's going to become obvious to people. We've got ourselves into this utterly false position. And the cheerleaders who got us into this utterly false position are going to become less and less popular. One of the sad things is you'll find, for example, that the invasion of Iraq, even though most people in the UK certainly were very much against it before it happened, there was a short period immediately after the invasion when the television news was full of British and American soldiers victoriously rolling through in their tanks, where jingoism made the invasion popular for a few months because it had succeeded and it was a great military victory and it's easy to whip up a stupid nationalist frenzy in favour of military victory. And we've got that kind of enthusiasm for the war in Ukraine. This idea that this is a glorious war being fought for democracy and it's victorious, etc. Once it becomes obvious it's not actually glorious, it's a terrible killing quagmire for young people and it's going nowhere,
And it had nothing to do with democracy, Craig.
And had them the stories of democracy and good versus evil, the tarnish wears off them, and people start, as military success doesn't happen, people will start to look behind a curtain and see the neo-Nazis and see the corruption and see the fact that this is not good versus evil. And at the moment, it's very hard to get those narratives over. But as the lack of success on the ground, as the shine wears off the whole thing, and as the economic costs at home become more and more apparent, I think public opinion will change. Now, that's probably a long process over the next 12, 15 months, but that's what I do believe will happen.
Let me just throw this in. Craig, the problem is that this is the least covered war. I mean, I get stuff from Newsweek and Business Insider on my phone all day long saying how Ukraine is doing great. Then I hear these other folks talking about it, that they're 400,000. That's where you get this number. I don't know what's going on. I don't think, even though I was there, I don't know what the numbers are. And it's hard for people. In Vietnam, you could gauge what was happening there. In Iraq, you could gauge what was happening there. Here, it's difficult. Roger?
I disagree with you. I don't think you didn't get any truth about Vietnam.
I'm just saying late in the game you did.
Well, a little bit, yeah. And yet it's still been the Vietnam narrative has somehow sort of got papered over in a way. Oh yeah, Vietnam, we don't talk about that. It's sort of, was it Jacob? No, nothing happened. Nobody got cashiered for telling all the lies, just like the Iraq War. McNamara, it's exactly like, you know, George Bush and Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice and Rumsfeld and Robert and all the rest of them. They're not in prison for telling all those awful lies and killing however many of American lives were lost in Iraq itself, and probably God knows how many Iraqi lives, but, you know, for nothing, really, just for hubris, just... They've actually, some of them have sort of come out and said that they wanted to get the taste of Vietnam out of their mouths, because they did have to admit, at least in private, that Vietnam was a huge defeat for the United States of America. They went there with all their bluster and bully boy attitude and saying, we're going to sort this out. And they didn't. They failed completely. And that did not sit well with them. And they blamed it, by the way. The warmongers who took you into Vietnam blamed it on the peaceniks. Oh, we could have won it easily if only we hadn't had these whining willies at home saying that it wasn't a good idea. We could have won it in a heartbeat. That's what they said after Vietnam, which is nonsense, obviously. And it may well be what they'll say when... You know where they're going to go, I think, because I'm happy to see that many, many people are now writing the sensible end to this war. There's a very good article from John Whitbeck this morning that I read by Anatoly somebody or other. I haven't got his name in front of me now. But he'd written an article about Sarkozy and all of that. And he's saying he's absolutely right. So what they're going to end up with is a variation of the Minsk Accords, which the Russians were perfectly prepared to accede to, and the talks that were interrupted by Boris Johnson's visit on April the 9th in 2022 were at an end. They were concluding those talks when Johnson went in and said, sorry, you can't do that. You're going to win. We'll change your minds. This is a guess, obviously, but he did turn up and they went from, we're nearly there, we're nearly at a peaceful solution. We've accepted that that this is a red line and it's very like the Cuban Missile Crisis and blah. And all of that logic and reason that was thrown into it. Ukraine is going to become neutral. It will not become part of NATO. The peoples of Luhansk and Donetsk will become at least partially autonomous, and we will go back to the status quo of the current border. The Crimea will stay as part of the Russian Federation forever, and blah. Now it's going to be the same result, only the the oblasts that will be allowed referenda are going to be a little bit further west than they were before the slaughter of all the young men and women.
Right.
But apart from that, it's going to be, when people say the Russians weren't prepared to negotiate, yes, they were. They tried to negotiate from 2008 until 2022, all day, every day, to negotiate a way round the firmly and clearly drawn. JFK fell in 1962 in the Cuban Missile Crisis. Khrushchev putting missiles on Cuba is exactly like you wanting Ukraine to become part of NATO. It ain't going to happen. Famously, Lavrov, the foreign minister of Russia back then, said, "Нет" means "нет".
Right. Craig, you get the last word here. We have 6 minutes left. I'm going to let you, because I know you're packing, and I'm going to see you tomorrow at the airport when you arrive
in
town.
I've got to go back to finding out why I've only got odd socks.
Yes.
What Roger said is absolutely right, and is what I've actually been saying since day one, that this war is going to end up with Crimea being Russian and essentially a variation on the Minsk agreements for the other places, with a probably UN police demarcation line and effective Russian control, but probably not actual official ceding of sovereignty of the Donbass region. And that could have been negotiated back in. I was actually there in Turkey for the talks. They weren't where I was acting as a kind of unofficial advisor to the Turkish government. They weren't quite as advanced as Roger was saying, but because we were at the proximity talk stage where the Russian and Ukrainian delegations weren't meeting directly. But they were meeting with the Turks, and the Turks are shuffling between the two. We're at that proximity talk stage, but the basic outlines were there exactly as they had to be. Exactly the agreement, as you know, with slight variations. It's been obvious all along what the end agreement will be, and it was. It was actually Blinken's visit to Ukraine more than Boris Johnson who told Peter that Blinken went to Ukraine and told the Ukrainians to forget it and stop it, and this is going to be a war to the finish. That's all certainly true. And it's extremely, extremely unpleasant. But the thing to remember, of course, is that the object is not to win the war. From the NATO point of view and from the American government point of view, the object is the war. The war is the object. They actually don't want it to end. A Ukrainian victory tomorrow isn't going to happen. But if it did happen, that's not what they want. They want something that's going to continue to bleed and weaken the Russian economy and give excuses for all kinds of crazy sanctions, and which is going to put huge amounts of money into their own military industrial machine. And they want to keep that going for years.
Blinken's already said that, Greg.
5-year war.
All right, Roger, you got the last word there, Roger.
Well, Blinken's already said, we've already won the war. Blinken said that last week, I think. The war is over. We won it.
Well,
which is a pretty bizarre thing to say. And it's, you know, obviously it's not just Blinken. There have been American politicians. Lindsey Graham, I think, famously said, it's absolutely brilliant. We're beating Russia, and we haven't wasted a single American life.
Richard Blumenthal said the same thing. All right, we have 1 minute. If you have anything to add, Roger, before we...
It's lovely to come down the club and meet you lovely people. And we're on the same path, and we're desperate to get Julian out of prison. That's step one, and then we can move on to step two. Right. But we have to keep amplifying the idea that is in the opera, that sweet reason, the voice of reason, is the thing that we've lost. There's no reason in Washington. Right. How much there is in Moscow, I've no idea. I don't speak Russian. I can't speak. But I do know that we've lost our reason in the West. Right. And in consequence, we live in a very nasty, mean, dangerous world.
All right.
And we don't want to. We want to live in a world where we can love our brothers and sisters, whatever their ethnicity or nationality or religion, and that we can cooperate one another, and so that peace talks in Turkey can succeed rather than being kiboshed by the powers that be.
Wow. I want to thank you both. Craig Murray, I'll see you this week. Roger, I hope to see you in the next couple of weeks. I love you both.
Good.
We're going to this is Military Madness by CSN, and we'll be right back to talk about William Kunstler. Crosby, Stills, and Nash & Young, a great tune to end that brilliant, not a brilliant segment by me, but by these two giants, Craig Murray and Roger Waters. I really appreciate them. I could just listen to them all day long, going back and forth. I'm Randy Critico. This is Randy Critico Live on the Fly here on 99.5 FM in New York City. And so now you just heard that discussion with music icon, activist, probably the loudest voice for Julian Assange, and certainly right now who's influenced more people with his tour. This is not a drill. I went to six of them, and every single venue was sold out. And so, you know, 20,000 people a shot, and maybe more in Milan and in Rome and in London saw it. And so we're talking about 1 million people. And then he had it on in theaters, a live performance in, from Frankfurt, I believe. So he's getting it out there, and he's been an invaluable voice for Julian Assange. And Craig Murray, with all of his commentary and his brilliant play-by-play analysis and reporting from when I went to the first phase of this charade kangaroo court trial with Judge, I think it was Judge, not Arbuthnot, it was somebody else at the time, Baritzer, back in February of 2021. Craig would watch the trial. He'd go out and we'd get something to eat, and he'd stay up until 3 o'clock in the morning and write a 5,000-word dispatch and come back and queue up in the morning for the next day's resumption of the trial. So Craig's going to be in town, as I said. And this is lightning in the bottle. Seeing Halley's Comet. He hasn't been here since he got the he gave the award to John Kiriakou in 2016. It's been 7 years. So he's coming here on this 2-week tour. He's going to be in Woodstock on Tuesday at Bear Cantina, and then that Saturday, September
9th at noon. There's a place called TikTok, you know where the New Yorker building is? Downstairs is called The Vault. There's a restaurant called Butcher and Banker. And so we got the room there, and you get lunch. You get lunch. They got great food. And you get to hear Craig Murray. He's going to address and he's going to take questions. And then introducing him and talking about the case is going to be Chris Hedges, and Margaret Kuntzer will be there as well. And I'll be there, but I'm not going to say much if I say anything at all. So I've added that to the Credico Super Special today. The Credico Super Special, Reggie, includes three documentaries revolving around Bill Kuntzler. One is Disturbing the Universe. If we could find a track from there, any track, we'll play some of it. It's that documentary. The second documentary is 2 years Scenes from the Drug War by, again, Emily and Sarah Kuntzler. Their maiden voyage making documentaries, and it won a lot of awards. In Woodstock, it won an award for best documentary. And Bill Kuntzler's very last public appearance with Irwin Corey, the Terry Waldo Ragtime Jazz Quintet, and me as the MC back in just 2 weeks before he died, which is Labor Day. And so we're going to focus on Kuntzler for the next half hour because he was such a giant and such an influential figure in my life. I got out of comedy because of Kuntzler. I just started doing nothing but benefits and fundraisers. And, we did something for the 20-year anniversary of Attica at Cayman Baptist Church with Reverend Walker and with Dick Gregory and Barry Crimmins and some of the Attica brothers and others back in 1991. And then I later took over the Kuntzler Fund in 97, and we worked against the Rockefeller drug laws and then the racist drug sting in Tulia, Texas. Later, the divestment portfolios from private prisons by the New York State Comptroller and the City Comptroller, or vice versa. So I did a lot of time with the Kuntzler Fund, and it's only because of Bill Kuntzler meeting him, and it drove me in that direction. Plus, my dad did 10 years in prison. So the two Bills, Bill Kuntzler and Bill Credico, definitely, it was not even free will. It was just like I had nothing to do with it. It just happened, that blend. And he's a very special person. I loved Bill Kuntzler. And like I said, he died 28 years ago this Labor Day. And so, Reggie, if you can somehow find the Chicago conspiracy, if you could just look through those titles, and I can ask you folks to support the station. You're not going to get programming like that. Go ahead, look at MSNBC all day long today. Tomorrow, CNN all day long tomorrow, or WNYC all day long tomorrow, the next day and the next day and next day. You will not get Roger Waters and Craig Murray. You won't see them. You won't see them anywhere. You just heard them here for an hour and 20 minutes, and what can I tell you? I mean, you heard it right here. Why would you want to, all right, I'm going to listen to this. This is great programming, but I don't want to pay for it. You know, somebody else, that guy who put $10 in from Greenhaven Prison a couple of weeks ago, gave 100% of his money. Let him pay for it. I'm just going to listen to it. I'm just going to listen to it like it's a public fountain. Well, someone's got to pay the freight here. Otherwise, we're not going to have this kind of programming here. Those three documentaries are live performances of Bill Kuntzler's last public appearance, and two epic documentaries by John Pilger, The Coming War on China and The War You Don't See, plus 60 Mimics, 1 and 2. And on top of that, you have a seat, a front row seat, the WBAI section for the luncheon with Craig Murray and with Craig Murray and with Chris Hedges. And if you either get this package, the Credico Super Special, for $120, you will get a seat there. Or if you become a buddy. Now, please start doing that because it's going to end at the end of this show. Linda's going to tell me the people who really appreciate the station and appreciate the quality of not me, but the guests that I have, Roger Waters and Craig Murray. Like I said, nowhere else. So for a $120 donation, you get all of that. All of those, the five DVDs and a CD, and you get to go to the luncheon. It includes lunch with Chris Hedges and with Craig Murray. For $120, please call 212-209-2950. If you want this kind of programming in New York City, you got to keep the station, because you're not going to hear Craig Murray and Roger Waters together anywhere else. Nowhere else. Roger Waters will be in the news all the time. He's such a superstar. He will be in the news, and he can pick and choose where he wants to go. But will he have a friendly interviewer? I mean, you think Jake Tapper is going to be a friendly interviewer? You know, he's been demonized with these such ridiculous allegations of anti-Semitism. His father died, Eric Fletcher Waters died fighting fascism, fighting the Nazis. In Anzio in 1943, this just months after Roger was born, or maybe it was 44, but he fought against the Nazis and what they represented. All right, he fought against anti-Semitism, and he died. So this is so ludicrous, and it's an orchestrated attack, COINTELPRO type of attack on Roger Waters, the same way they went after Jeremy Corbyn. You just throw in anti-Semitism, and then you have to take that mud off your body. It's just the basest mudslinging one could possibly inflict on another human being. And they did it with one of the great in music. There's no one. No one since Paul Robeson, who has been actively fighting on the streets and in his work against fascism, and Roger Waters. So you had him on, and that's why I'm asking you to support the station. 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950. We are against the ropes. You know, I don't like to do this. I could have had these guys on for another 30 minutes, although I do want to play this Bill Kunstler clip. If I don't know if it exists, Reggie, but it does, but I don't know what it's titled.
I got it.
You got it. All right, so I'm going to play this. This is Bill Kunstler in Chicago, and then stick around. You'll just get 9 minutes of me asking you to go to 212-209-2950, 212-209-2950, Decretico Super Special. It includes lunch with Craig Murray. He'll be in town one day. He'll be performing, or not performing, but he'll be lecturing or speaking here, taking a Q&A. And then we're going to D.C. and Minneapolis and other places. So, please call that number, 212-209-2950. Don't let this station die at this critical moment in human history. All right, here's Bill Kunstler. This is Chicago. This is The Conspiracy. This is from Disturbing the Universe by Emily and Sarah Kunstler.
The people disagree with the political decisions that have been made upon their heads, that whenever the people disagree with those political decisions, the racist power structure sends in guns and force to see that the people accept those political decisions. But we are here as revolutionaries to let them know that we refuse to accept those political decisions that maintain the oppression of our black people and other people in the world.
What do we want? Revolution!
When?
Now!
What do we want?
Revolution!
When?
Now!
America watched as Chicago erupted when protesters converged on the Democratic National Convention in 1968.
The cops beat up the kids in Chicago. And more than half the nation figured they deserved it. We were a very angry nation.
I mean, we always wanted a confrontation, but we wanted not a physical confrontation, but a symbolic confrontation, to present a different world a different view of how life should be.
What it was really about is power, the power of the state to suppress dissent versus the power of social movements to stand up in the face of repression.
A year later, the government put 8 activists on trial for conspiracy to incite a riot. And Dad became their lead counsel.
We felt like Bill was part of the movement. And what's more, since he knew that the defendants' lives were on the line, he was going to allow the defendants to define the terms of what went on in the courtroom. And that is a big deal because he was putting his own life in jeopardy as well when he chose to do that.
Gene Fritz was one of the Chicago jurors. At the time of the trial, Gene was 51 years old, voted Republican, and ran an auto supply store with her husband. Jean saved every newspaper article and still has the journal she kept during the trial.
God, I forgot about that notebook she's looking
through. Kunstler is a very casual dresser, almost like he has no time for clothes. He has let his hair grow since he has been here, wears glasses, and is always bending down to pull up his socks. He sure wears some flashy ties. He has been forgetting to comb his hair lately.
I can't believe I wrote all that.
Me neither.
Well, of course, it was just almost the beginning of long hair, and I wasn't used to people like that yet. You know, I came from Des Plaines, a smaller town, and I wasn't into stuff like that. So at first, I was a little taken back.
To understand what happened today, you have to set your Yippie decoding ring to D72 and pay very strict attention. The odds have now shifted from 7-5 in favor of the Kangaroos because if you remember today's testimony by the Chicago Police Department, they have conclusively proved...
The trial was theater. Defendants wore judges' robes and police uniforms. Poets and musicians were called to testify. Dad's clients wanted to bring the 60s into the courtroom and to challenge the government's repression of their right to speak their minds. But the major conflict of the trial was between the judge and defendant Bobby Seale.
Sit down, man. I said, no. The Sixth Amendment say I got a right to have my legal counsel. I says, and you can't sit up here and deny me the right to defend myself. Sit down, Mr. Seale. I says, you're going to deny? I says, you're a racist, a fascist, and a bigot.
Seale suggested that the judge was a racist. Anyone who would stand up before a U.S. District Court and accuse the judge of racism is utterly absurd, he said. What about my constitutional rights, judge? Mr. Marshall advised the defendant that he cannot speak.
This drawing depicts one of the most dramatic and bizarre developments of the Chicago trial. Bobby Seale, a Black Panther leader, was bound and gagged when he refused to obey the judge's orders.
It was absolutely sickening. You just felt that the world was coming to an end, that you were actually seeing this in the United States of America. Somebody tied up like he was. That's when I learned not to like my government and not trust them. And that's hard to say, but that's how I felt.
Stop this medieval torture that's going on in this courtroom. This man wants to defend himself. This is an unholy disgrace to the law that's going on in this courtroom.
When you begin to keep your word around here that you gave the court, perhaps things can be done.
I just feel so utterly ashamed, Your Honor, to be an American lawyer at this moment.
You should be ashamed.
I know I should be, and
you should be ashamed of your conduct in this case.
Dad was always emotional when he spoke about what was done to Bobby Seale in that Chicago courtroom. Years later, he was still ashamed that he stood there while a black man sat in chains.
Stop the trial! 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 Stop the trial!
The Deputy Chairman of the Illinois Black Panther Party, Brett Hampton!
Yeah!
all power to the people. And I just want to tell you that the chairman of the Black Panther Party is going to be ungagged, and they're going to have to take those chains off him. But they're only going to have to do that if there's enough organization.
4 weeks later, Black Panther leader Fred Hampton was shot to death in his bed by the Chicago police. And Dad realized that the government would stop at nothing to destroy people it viewed as its enemy.
That was completely a setup by the FBI. And I found out later an agent had confessed to me, who was supervisor of that squad in Chicago, said that the FBI had set up the police for the raid, hoping that the police would kill maybe a couple of dozen Panthers.
I killed them. And when I say I mean all the white people of the United States killed Fred Hampton, just as we've killed every black man, because we've stood by racists, all of us, and watched the society continue a slavery that was supposed to have died 100 years ago. In particular, he was killed by the system that is resisting every voice of dissent and every wind of change.
Right. Whew. That always gets to me, Reggie. So tell us about the special.
What special?
The premium. I get tears when I hear Bill Kunstler talk.
Well, you know, I've seen this documentary more than a few times already, and it's one of the reasons why a station like WBAI needs to exist and needs to continue to exist, because we're unafraid to present material as like this documentary that was played. The idea, you know, and again, for someone like a William Kunstler doing what he has done, and was honest and candid about some of the things that he did not do, I always find so inspiring and respectful, because he understand his privilege. And even when he didn't do the things that he could have fully done, you know, he took onus on that. He took an L on that one. And I think that we need to understand, this country right now would be in a better situation right now if we were honest as someone like a William Kunstler, and stop pretending that American exceptionalism is that democracy in this country, if there was ever such a thing, is happening. It's the best thing since sliced bread, and it isn't. There's a lot of things that this country needs to do in order to improve itself. But one of the things it needs to improve on is admitting that there is a plenty of wrongs that are happening in the present as well as the past. The past has enabled this present that we live in today. And Disturbing the Universe, this documentary that is part of this super pack, this Credico super pack, for what, $120?
$120.
$120.
Five DVDs.
Is it five DVDs now?
One CD.
One
yes,
CD.
And Lunch with Craig Murray
lunch
now.
Lunch with Craig Murray.
And
this coming
and
Sunday.
It's following Sunday.
Oh, the following Sunday.
Right.
I'm sorry. The following Sunday.
So you got
Sunday.
7 minutes to try to get in. We'll give you a few minutes over, but you have to ask for the Credico Super Special or be a buddy of Live on the Fly.
Because really, honestly, this documentary on its own is worth it. This documentary on its own is worth it. And we need to collectively have serious discussions about what this country can be and what it actually is. And the thing is, and one of the very important and poignant things about WBAI is that we are allowed to have these uncomfortable discussions. They're awkward. I know they're awkward, and there are people that will get defensive over these things. Yes, I know that. I know there are listeners like now that are calling up and just feeling kind of icky or uncomfortable. But you know what? That's what it's supposed to be. If there's some kind of uncomfort that you're experiencing right now that you have heard, first of all, that means you have a conscience. Good for you. And second of all, you're not too sure what to do in order to improve on this whole thing. But that's okay, too, because you understand that there is something uncomfortable about what you have just heard. It is something inner, within your inner consciousness, that starts to understand that there is something not quite right. You can't put your finger on it, but it's something that's not quite right. And that's why something like this, and that's why a show like Live on the Fly needs to continue to be supported in a venue that will allow something like this that's been happening for over 60 years, right. 63 years exactly.
Well, you know, Reggie, the prior generations since the advent of WBAI, every generation knew how important it was, and they kept it alive for the next generation. We are the only generation, and many of us are from that generation back in the 60s, that have not done our responsibility and kept this right. alive for the next generation.
Right.
I mean, it's unconscionable, and I don't want to be heavy-handed here, but people just listen to the program. I get emails and calls, that was a great show, and then somebody else is paying for this. You know, I don't need to call up and make a donation. Well, I've thrown in everything I possibly can
right.
with the Credico Super Special today to try to help. And I've used my time the last 3 out of 4 weeks to do fundraising here rather right. than just and trying to give you some content. You just heard an hour with two brilliant
amazing.
Individuals.
It was an amazing
and you know what? I could have spent the whole time playing excerpts of this
easily.
Documentary.
Easily.
I could easily have done easily. That or from two scenes from the drug war. But I'm asking you folks in the waning minutes that we have here is to please – you know, get up there and you're standing for us on, stand for WBAI. I mean, you talk about indispensable entities locally, internationally, that are on the brink of expiring. I mean, is that what you want? I mean, so I won't have another interview
right.
with Craig Murray and Roger Waters again, or if Julian Assange gets out. I had three interviews with them. We won't have that again, or with John Pilger, Stefania Morizzi. Won't have that again at this station because the station will be run by the
right.
Democratic Party and you can get WNYC. Let me just give the number
right.
out.
212-209-2950.
212-209-2950. You just can't sit the ring in your hands, folks. You've got to help out this station. I mean, that's why I'm doing this today. I was just going to have Craig Murray promoting my event in 10 days or our event in 10 days.
And
NYC Free Assange and Assange Countdowns event in 10 days. But this is so critical to keep this station. That's why I keep, you know, throwing aside just doing a show and ignoring what's happening here. But I see what's happening here, and we are on the brink. And it could be at the end of this month if people don't act.
Yeah,
it could be at the end of this month if people don't act right now. And when it's all over, I'm going to tell you, someone's going to say it's too bad what happened to WBAI. I'm going to say, how much did you give? If you have cable, that's $200 a month, right?
Right.
So if you were to give $5 a week for this show, that's $250. You got the whole year of this show for $250. I certainly don't fundraise when I'm doing Assange Countdown to Freedom, my podcast. I don't make any money off it. I'm not making any money
right.
here. I want this station because I grew up when I moved to New York in the 80s listening to the station.
Right.
Go ahead, Reggie.
Yeah, there was a couple of things I wanted to add to that. One being I want to be here during the time when you do your interview with Julian Assange as a free man. I mean, like, that would be an amazing interview because of considering of all the due diligence that you have been doing and making sure that someone like a Julian Assange is set away from the shackles that he's experiencing. Second thing that I would be looking forward to that. Second of all is that we need to understand the priorities here and what WBAI means to people who are listening to this radio station. And you have said before, cable, look, you know that cable viewership has gone down 40% since 2020. Okay. Meaning that, and one of the reasons why the viewership of cable news has been going down is because 57%, according to the Crain's business report back in 2022, 56% of the people who said that they no longer watch cable news is because they feel like they're being lied to.
Right.
Okay. And yet there are still a number of individuals out there that are still happily paying their cable bill in order to be lied to. Right. And I think the thing is, we need to understand priorities. If you respect information that is given